Hello, everyone, and welcome to another interview in the Innovation and Creativity Summit 2017. I'm very happy to have Dr. Arne Dietrich with me today. Dr. Dietrich is the Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience at the American Institute of Beirut, and he's also the author of How Creativity Happens in the Brain. Dr. Dietrich, it's lovely having you here.
Hi. How are you?
I'm very good. Apologies if the connection's not the best. I understand you're calling us from Lebanon, is that right?
Yeah, Beirut, Lebanon, and sometimes the connection is not as good as you expect it to be or you want it to be. It's part of the game.
No problem. So for the people who aren't aware of you or what your work is, could you just give us a brief background as to how you got into the study of creativity?
Yeah, for my background, I'm a neuroscientist, I'm a cognitive neuroscientist, and my expertise is really the neuroanatomy of the frontal cortex, sort of the highest order neural mass that we have that makes us so uniquely us, not some other thing. And that makes me also interested in the cognitive functions that are unique to us. And one or two of the things that I'm most interested in over the last 10, 15 years is consciousness and creativity. And as a neuroscientist, I'm mostly interested in mechanisms. That means how the brain manages to be so outrageously creative for our species. That is really a unique trait.
And that's one of the reasons I'm so keen to speak to you today. We've got a lot of other people speaking about how creativity works for them and other people in neuroscience or psychology describing experiments about how creativity can be improved and what situations help or hinder creativity. But today we're really going to be talking about the cells in the brain and how this amazing instrument between our ears ends up developing symphonies and iPhones and concepts about the universe and everything that has to do with creativity.
For me, neuroscience is unkind to common sense. One of the things that I often find is that the kinds of things I work on no longer mesh well with experience. People hope always they get neuroscientific explanations that somehow connect to their experience. But very often I work with levels of explanations that you no longer have introspective access to, and the mechanisms are quite removed. But still I try to make my kind of work relevant to how people experience creativity, but that's not what I do. My own creative process, or in my own creative process, I do not talk about the level of experience, but levels below this of how neurostructures, neuroanatomy, neurochemistry, and physiology may contribute to us having new ideas about new stuff.
So the $1 million question that I'm sure is on everyone's mind is, where exactly in the brain is the creative part of the brain? I know a lot of people know about this myth of it being in the right part of the brain, and there's this distinction between left brain, right brain people. I always tell everyone the evidence that that doesn't work, but why don't you give us your insights as to the structure of the brain and how that affects creativity?
Yeah, surely the right brain, left brain. I've heard this thing on all continents, in all languages, from all kinds of people. It's a very common myth, misconception, and it's not just you, but just pretty much everybody in the field agrees that this is a theory that will be treated like nuclear waste and buried for a million years. I think it is one of the best examples of phrenology. When you have a complex psychological function or faculty like creativity, you can be pretty sure that there is no one brain area for it. Just like there's no brain area for God or for your political conviction or for your idea or concept of democracy. And these are functions that are distributed in the brain. So the short answer to where in the brain is creativity, as in neuroanatomy, as in location, the short answer is everywhere. It's a distributed function, and it depends on which type of creativity you're talking about. So for instance, if you are a writer and you work verbal with language, you would rather look in language areas. If you are a visual artist or you play music or you do mathematical theorems, you would look in different areas. What is much more interesting is the processes that work in these areas. But in terms of neuroanatomy, we can be pretty sure in saying that it is everywhere. It is a bit like trying to, you can use a satellite. I think that's the best metaphor. You can use a satellite to find England on the map. But you can't use a satellite to find all the people in the world that speak English because they are distributed. And that is certainly true for the neuroanatomy of creativity.
So, I mean, that's both great news for people wanting to understand how it works, but it's also very scary news for people who are approaching the field of creativity research and the people watching and listening who want to sort of get the easy answer about what part of the brain is most active.
The thing is, even if I were to tell you, creativity is located in some unpronounceable area of the neocortex, it still wouldn't give you a mechanism. It would give you a location. That still doesn't mean that we understand how it works, just because we know where it works. So the fact that it is distributed and everywhere doesn't change the fact that we're still hunting mechanisms, not locations.
One thing I do want to ask, and I don't know if you have the answer to this, though, is creativity seems to be a uniquely human trait. There don't seem to be any animals that have the ability to ask questions or think up imaginative solutions, even though you might see a donkey with a paintbrush painting. It's not the same as a human being painting. Is there something about the human brain that seems to be uniquely suited to coming up with new novel solutions in a creative way?
I think I would have a lot of colleagues that would have a problem in saying that animals are not creative. You take problem solving in chimpanzees, they have some inside solutions, and some of them are very clever. Some of them are very creative, certainly. But I also don't think that very few people would disagree with the statement that there is a gigantic gap between us and the next chimp in terms of creativity, in terms of language, and a few other cognitive functions. Our ability to be creative, the way we are creative, since we are the species on this planet, that changes just about everything. There isn't an element of the periodic table we haven't tinkered with, not an environment that we haven't changed. Our ability certainly has to do with the complexity of our brain. I think that is a safe thing to say, and particularly the complexity of the neocortex, the prefrontal cortex included.
So let's find out then, at a basic level, for people who aren't neuroscientists, what different parts of the brain do we know have relationships to creativity? A lot of people will know at a basic level what a neuron is, but they might not necessarily know what the difference between gray matter and white matter is. Or the links between the two hemispheres of the brain. So in your research, what do you find at a structural level, what mechanisms do we know about that actually influence creativity?
Well, in terms of gray matter and white matter, gray matter is called gray matter because cells are gray, and white matter is called white matter because the axons are myelinated, and myelin is a protein that's white. But if you take the two together, you cannot attribute creativity to any one of these two parts or any one network or any one structure. Is to think of your brain as a network of neurons. And once you start looking at the network level, at pathways rather than particular structures, you're getting more to the heart of how neurons communicate. And again, that has to do with complexity. The same way you have information processing in a computer, it is the way the information is combined, the way associations are made, remote they are in a network, that provides combinations of information that are novel, that are new, and are creative in the sense that they are also useful. And certainly the more higher up structures contribute more to it. Areas, for instance, the cortex would contribute information that would be in your memory, in your data bank. Other areas of frontal cortical areas would be involved in attentional processing, so that you can attend to a problem, or also the opposite, not attend to it, and then have an aha moment, have an aha effect. But these processes, perception, attention, different types of memory, they all would go into of how the information is being processed, so that it is combined in a way that's novel and creative and useful.
I'm really keen to find out a bit more about this combination of ideas, because one thing that I'm still trying to learn about happening in the brain is, I know that during the subconscious, the brain is taking all the information it knows and trying out various new combinations between bits of knowledge or imaginative ideas and building out networks. Are these just electrical impulses that are randomly going through the brain, or is there actual physical new connections between neurons that are being formed and broken? Do we know?
We do know both. Once Your experience as you go through life changes the structure of your brain, which is why when you die, your brain looks different to mine, because I had different experiences. But these are processes that take time, quite a bit of time. For neurons to connect to one another, that's probably easier, quicker than actual neurons going and coming and going. It means neurogenesis. Neuro or synaptogenesis, the making of connections. But in a network like this, it's not really physically a new connection. Think of it in terms of, let's say, all of your friends on Facebook and somebody else's friends on Facebook. They may have a few nodes of information combined, but they may have never been used, so that your network is separate from another network. But it is just how the information is routed that it can go through some nodes to make connections to another network. That doesn't mean you have to create a new node. The node might already exist, but has not been used. And think of a network like that, like millions and millions of connections. And what matters really is how information is routed from one node to another node. And it can flow in so many different ways that you can make new connections without actually having physically to make a connection, as in a neuron connecting to another neuron via a synapse. This may happen. This takes more time, but this is probably not the most likely mechanism when you have an aha moment, when you have an insight, there's a new connection. That is probably not the case, because it takes too much time.
So we've talked about the mechanism of the structure of the brain and how creativity seems to involve all parts of the brain for various different types of creativity. I know in your book you also talk about other mechanisms around cognition related to creativity. What do you mean by that?
One of the most important things that we have to do in creativity research is find the way information flows through a system, and that can be modeled and described. And the basic algorithm the brain uses in order to come up with new information can be described mathematically in an abstract form as an evolutionary algorithm. Essentially, think of yourself as, let's say you want to be creative, you want to solve a mathematical problem, or you stand in front of a canvas which is completely white and you want to draw a painting. You want to play a piece of music, you want to improvise in jazz. Whenever you are in front of some situation like this, where your creativity is being required, asked for, necessary, you can think of this as an unknown solution space. You are in an unknown solution space. The whole point of creating something is to create something in a solution space that is basically where the topography is unknown. So how do you walk such a solution space? You're in the middle of it and you have to walk somewhere. You have to make steps towards some solution or towards some things that you'd like. What you do is to do a couple of steps and figure out whether they work. You may go and continue in that direction or you take another direction. That entire way of looking at it can be described mathematically as an evolutionary algorithm. A variation test, a variation selection, a generate and test algorithm. And we can implement these sort of algorithmic functions in a neural network. And that's where you see where a network starts to become creative, in the sense that it comes up with a combination of information that might be novel. And so the important thing is also to understand the computational and cognitive processes. So an evolutionary algorithm would be a computational process. A cognitive process would be that we need to figure out, for what types of creativity do you require more attention? What kind of attentional processes? For some other type of creativity, it may be less attentional processes. But either way, the way attention figures into consciousness is something that we don't understand well. The same is true for memory. The same is true for perception. We need to have a better understanding what types of creativity go with what cognitive function, and the computational processes that enable them to confirm how information is computed in general.
It's fascinating you say that, because one of the things that has started forming the basis of a lot of the consulting that I do is this idea that the brain has evolved to such a degree that it's now extremely good at spotting patterns and working off memory and essentially working on autopilot. And if it's set a challenge that it knows the answer to, and that challenge could be just drive to work the same way that you've driven to work before, or write a letter which is extremely similar to a letter you've written before, it essentially doesn't really trigger much creativity because it just does what it's done before. Is that because it's more energy efficient for the brain to do it that way, or how?
Now, certainly, when you have behaviors that are adaptive, useful, and you form a pattern, it is much more efficient. The brain is a machine that costs already enormous amounts of energy. 20% of your metabolic resources go into an organ that is only 2% of your body weight, the brain. And so, yes, whenever it can economize, it will. Conquer and divide is the general principle. As soon as you have a behavior, we have it licked, we give it to lower brain structures to work on. That means also then it becomes ever more difficult to break that pattern. And breaking that pattern becomes more and more difficult the more it is ingrained. Yeah? And it requires then that you take different routes. And that seems to be the one thing that sometimes is hardest for us, to break these patterns and create something, because we have gotten used to doing things one way or another so much. Yeah. And I think great creators in that sense have more of an ease with what we would call in the field cognitive flexibility. And cognitive flexibility is essentially the breaking of patterns.
It's something that I describe to people as coming up against your comfort barrier. Because a lot of people, if they're asked to come up with ideas, they will list out memories and it'll be very easy and feel very comfortable for them. But the minute that that bucket of easy ideas runs out and they need to come up with more different ideas, it starts becoming physically quite uncomfortable for people. They get anxious.
Yeah, and also you see a function here of age. The older you get, the more these patterns become ingrained, the more difficult it comes to break them. It's not a surprise that there's a tendency for younger people to make the true innovations, the breakthrough innovations, the Nobel Prizes, to break the patterns in the arts or in any genre of film, music, theater, or paintings. It's the younger people that do the revolutions, not the older ones. And that has to do with patterns and exactly what you've been saying. Cognitive flexibility decreases with age.
So can you tell us a bit more about your research specifically into creativity? What have you found from your research in the field of, well, creativity research?
I've done theoretical work over the last 6, 7, 8 years. The reason why is because the current experimental work is flawed. I've also done most of the theoretical work to figure out where exactly it is flawed. Because some of the creativity tests that have been used in the field might work quite well in order to predict real-life creativity, but they cannot be used in neuroscience. And the reason why is because they commit several errors. One is the false category formation, and the other one is the compound construct. And because of these two flaws, the tests are theoretically incoherent for us. Look at it this way. We in neuroscience, we hunt mechanisms. What we want, if you have a phenomena, is look at levels of explanations below, not above. That means we want to break down the beat and see what it is made out of. For that, we need to isolate the processes. If you take a creativity test, like, for instance, the alternative uses test, the main problem is that the alternative uses test doesn't test for creativity. It's a divergent thinking test. And we have no idea what kind of processes go into divergent thinking. That means how much attention you need, less, or perceptual processes, or working memory, or reference memory, or semantic memory. And these are the things we can measure with a function MRI. And if we don't know what goes into the basket there, we don't know what comes out the other end. So part of the problem is that we currently don't have a good paradigm to bring people in the lab and control the variables such that we can make inferences about mechanisms. We still need to work better on our understanding of what creativity is, and by that I mean what type of creativity can be clearly distinguished from what other types of creativity. Only once we break down creativity into pieces, can we then perhaps break it down into more pieces? Can we then perhaps get one piece of one chunk and test this in a function model? The big thing of creativity in a function MRI makes no sense. It is theoretically incoherent, and most of that work is flat-out pseudoscience.
Well, in which case, why is there so much well-regarded, well-cited work that produces these fMRI? For the people who don't know what fMRI is, it's functional magnetic resonance imaging. And if you ever see a picture of a brain with either green or red or yellow or blue highlights on it. That's the output of one of these brain scanners that shows where the brain is being activated. And there's more and more research over the last couple of decades which is showing where in the brain either more or less activity is happening during these creativity exercises. But are you suggesting that this isn't actually representative of what's really happening in the brain?
Yeah, well, two things. One, functional eye research is extremely successful and very good. This is not a critique of functional eye in general. It's extremely good work. But what is, of course, the tricky part of doing good functional eye work is the experimental setup. And that setup needs to ask the right question. Otherwise, the functional eye is the wrong tool to deliver the answer. Now, the creativity literature has actually decreased over the last few years because of critique of it has made it so difficult to continue doing the same thing. That means it's a sort of a cookie cutter template. You take an alternative uses test, take a functional MRI, something is going to light up, something has to light up, it's a mental test, and this is a functional MRI, and you publish it. But that was perhaps easier to do 10 years ago, 8 years ago. Nowadays it's much more difficult because we know now why it is flawed. So the functional MRI work has actually decreased when it comes to creativity. There would have been many, many more functional MRI studies if I think the critique would have not been articulated the way it has. I think you would see practically a study every day, and you don't. That it still continues has to do primarily also with people having, quite frankly, formed a bit of an echo chamber. There are a number of groups of people that work on this, and they continue with the same kind of work. Yeah, but this is sort of a self-perpetuating thing. And they are not yet quite, with the plan that the rug has been pulled out from underneath them. And so they continue. There's also a lot of perseveration of people hoping that there's still somehow that they can do something with the creativity tests. So that area has not yet fully died. But I cannot see that it wouldn't, given the inconsistent results that come out. You pick up any creativity study with a functional MRI, and you get one set of results. Try it. You pick up another study, you get another set of results. You get a third study, you get another set of results. What are you supposed to make of this? There's no consistency at all, and the reason why is because it's fundamentally, theoretically flawed. But I have no doubt that next year we're going to have another 3-4 studies. And the year after that, another 3-4 studies. It's just how the world works.
In which case, if these fMRI studies are fundamentally flawed, what good research do you think is out there that is actually helping to push the field forward?
I think one of the things that is probably the best in terms of functional MRI, EEG and others, is if you take a particular type of creativity. And there's one set that doesn't use the alternative uses test or any of the other parts of the Torrance test or others, where we have a better idea of pinpointing things because they test for a specific part or for a specific process. And I think the best work on functional MRI and creativity has been done on music, not on the alternative uses test. And the one on music is different because it can isolate the process. This has been work done by several groups all over, and they use jazz improvisation or some other improv kind of setup where they have a control condition, which is standard, and one where you creatively improvise. Since this is musical, it also activates completely different parts of the brain than, for instance, the alternative uses test would. Yeah, and here it is much easier to pinpoint what kind of processes might be involved. So there is, for instance, work out that shows that during jazz improvisation, you have a downregulation of frontal cortical functions. This is called hyperfrontality. That is that your control system, your conscious control system, is a bit downregulated. And that is also what makes this flow when you do the jazz improvisation. Those are, for instance, pieces of research that have given us valuable insight of certain types of creativity.
Is this all the sort of stuff that you talk about in your book, How Creativity Works in the Brain?
It's part of it, yes. You look at what we have, and you have to discern what works, what doesn't. And I think the way forward is that we get an ever better theoretical understanding of the different types of creativity, so that when we have the beast in pieces that we can actually look at mechanisms because we have broken it down small enough to hold on to one particular piece. That is the key part.
So what do you mean by different types of creativity?
We can most certainly distinguish three types of creativity given what we know about the brain and how the brain works. And they do mesh well with your experience. You can have one type where you deliberately, systematically solve a problem. Yeah? That you can call it the deliberate type if you want. And that is personified by people like Edison. Thomas Edison has taken a piece of equipment and looks, what can I do, what can I improve, and turns all the knobs until he has something new. He has 1,093 patents, still the record in the US Patent and Trademark Office. You can also, of course, have the other type. This is the type that people mostly associate with creativity, and that's the type where the idea just comes to you. It's not at all methodological, it's not at all systematic. Try to solve a problem, you can't, you get frustrated. You incubate it. You go cooking, or take a shower, or do something else, and all of a sudden it hits you like a ton of bricks. On the first type, the deliberate type, you focus your attentional resources onto the problem. Okay? That should certainly be a very different type than the second type I described, where your attentional processes are la-la land. You can already see from these two types that they must be associated with completely different brain processes. Yeah? And there's a third type. At the very least, there's a third type. There are probably more, but these three we can distinguish. And the third is flow. And the flow type is different because it produces fluid motor output. And this bypasses cleanly consciousness. When you ask people in a flow mode, they are creative in flow without thinking about it. There's no insight. They do not try. They also don't have an aha moment. They just have a flow moment. And this is also, given the phenomenology that people report being in that state, is certainly going to be a very different type when it comes to brain mechanisms. So these three types, at the very least, we can distinguish.
Are you just describing the difference between convergent and divergent thinking, or is there more behind it?
No. The difference between convergent thinking and divergent thinking can still be with or without attention. Let me give you an example, for instance. You can have a divergent thinking test, like the alternative uses test, and pull all your concentration onto finding alternative uses for a brick or for a tire. Yeah, you can also do this with a convergent process. So convergent and divergent, you can do both in the deliberate mode. And you can do both in the spontaneous mode. So they don't overlap. The problem with divergent thinking is primarily that we know that divergent thinking can produce idea generation. We also know that convergent thinking can produce idea generation. So the obvious question then is to ask, yeah, what is it about divergent thinking or convergent thinking that is creative? Because obviously, this is logic 101. If both convergent thinking and divergent thinking can be both creative and non-creative, you're going to have to tell me, what is it about divergent thinking that is creative? It makes no sense. You see that? And that's the primary problem of using the alternative uses test with a function MRI and then making conclusions about creativity. You see the theoretical incoherence there.
I find that fascinating because it's very different than what, at a basic level, you learn from creativity research. But taking that a step further around this concept of attention, one thing that I wanted to ask you is there any research or evidence behind this concept of as you wake up throughout the day, the relaxation or activity levels within the brain will change? So you start out with a more alpha state brain, and as you focus more, you go into a more beta state, beta wave brain. Is that something that actually happens?
No. That's, I think, a simplification that doesn't stand that way. But first of all, the brain doesn't change activity globally. All changes you have are regional shifts. The brain is a fixed container and always gets the same amount of resources in terms of oxygen, glucose, blood perfusion. So you do not have a brain state and a resting state. It's a misconception. Even during sleep, your brain uses the same amount of energy there when you're not sleeping. Yeah? What shifts are the resources within. So for instance, alpha and beta are terms that are used for EEG. And EEG only records activity from the cortex because the electrodes are right on the cortex. So it doesn't, for instance, record deeper down in the brain. Okay? So when you wake up, you're in an alpha state simply because the cortex is not as activated. As you go through the day, the cortex is more activated, but not the whole brain. And that also depends. Beta activity certainly is associated with information processing. But that includes both creative information processing and normal information processing, whatever that is, actually. We don't even know what that is. Yeah? But normal consciousness or normal creative thinking and non-creative thinking, both are associated both with beta and alpha. Again, it depends the type of creativity you're thinking about and the type of brain processes. You have to find ways to dissect the problem into pieces that can actually be investigated.
And then finally, I wanted to ask you about one of the buzzwords which has been around the creativity research community, which is the default mode network. And for the people who don't know much about it, could you explain structurally what the default mode network is and how people have been describing its role in creativity and what your views on it are?
Yeah. So the default mode network is a thing that's been around for like 10, 15 years and is a result of functional MRI studies that needed a control condition. So if you have a normal cognitive task, you ask your participants to be either in a control condition or the experimental condition. So what do you do in the control condition? You ask people in the functional MRI to please do nothing. This is sort of supposedly a resting state. Yeah? Over the years, people of course don't do nothing. The brain cannot do nothing. So over the years, people have found that that particular condition activates a set of structures. And that's called the default mode network because it's sort of the default. Yeah? It includes part of the parietal cortex, part of the frontal cortex. And you can think of it as a global network because it includes several different parts of the brain. It is inverse related to another network called the central executive network. It has overlaps in them, but if one goes up, the other one goes down. And that has been associated with whether something is task dependent, that means whether you pay attention to a particular task and try to solve it, or you daydream. When you daydream, your default network is activated. And when you solve a problem, your central executive network is activated. And again, associating one with creativity and the other one not with creativity is phrenology. It's a false category formation. With the example of Edison or Johann Sebastian Bach, if you very systematically solve problems, you can be creative. So your central executive network can also be creative. So can your default mode network. You cannot divide creativity this way. You carve nature at the wrong joints. This is a false category formation to associate creativity with one network and not with the other, because both do both. And you have the same problem that you had with divergent and convergent thinking. So to associate the default mode network with creativity is false. And I think we can demonstrate this. To say, for instance, the default mode network might be associated with a particular type of creativity, that in that direction we could walk, that could yield something. But the whole of creativity associating with the default mode network is false outright.
So in which case, the last question I want to ask you, because we're coming up to the end of our interview, is if budget and time weren't an issue and researchers in the world could have whatever they need to do their work, what do you think needs to happen to take creativity research to the next level?
I think the most important next level for us is twofold. One, we have to work on the computational processes. And that means that in creativity research, we need to involve people in artificial intelligence, computer science, and cognitive science, and be much more interdisciplinary when it comes to computer modeling, when it runs to simulations, because we're talking essentially information processing in a network. And I think there's a whole group of people that are not doing or not helping because they're not involved in the type of creativity. So this is one thing. The other thing is that we need to do much better research when it comes to, and I've mentioned this now already 3-4 times, much better theoretical work that will yield a paradigm that we can test currently, we don't have a good paradigm. And the creativity results that we currently find are not at the level that I think will stand the test of time because they're inconsistent. So getting our heads together, all of us in creativity research, the most important thing is to come up with new measures of creativity, psychometric tests that test particular type of particular types, and they need to be developed. And that is, I think, where the bottleneck currently is. And it doesn't actually require much money. It requires a theoretical work on all levels, educational level, but also in terms of cognitive levels, social levels, neuroscience levels, to get better testing than we currently have because of the validity of the creativity tests and our inability to use them in a lab setting.
Perfect. And then the last thing I like to ask all the experts is, do you have one tip or one actionable insight that people watching and listening to this can go out and try either this afternoon or change over the next week to become better at creativity and to become better at generating new ideas?
I do have a few for myself, but I have made the point throughout my life, because I get this question every single time, to dodge that bullet, because I am not confident enough that I can say something that is founded enough for me in the basic sciences that we understand creativity, that is a sort of prescription of something you can do in order to enhance your creativity. I have found for myself a couple of things that work for me, but I don't think they're generalizable. So let me allow me to dodge that bullet. I will not do this because my area of expertise is basic sciences. And there I want to play sort of the conservative scientist that you are used to, that doesn't jump to conclusions about what to do and not to do.
Perfect. We're going to have links to all the resources below the video in the description. Can you just let people know where that's going to take them?
Can I come again?
Where are the links in the description going to take people?
The links in the description on my website, on it takes people to basically my work. I'm a scientist, so I do experiments. I have therefore publications, and they are mostly academic, except for my latest book, which is written for a large audience, but it's still quite technical. I wrote it so that my mother could read it, who is highly educated, but still I think it would be challenging for some people. And so the links will take people to my writings, to my work, academic and otherwise.
Perfect. It's been wonderful having you here, and I look forward to speaking again with you soon.
Okay. Thank you.
Congratulations on being part of the Innovation and Creativity Summit. I'm sure that if you continue to watch the other expert interviews, you will experience an improvement in your capability to turn your ideas into something valuable. But don't forget, to get the very best experience and ensure you don't miss any of the priceless lessons, you should invest in yourself with the All Access Pass. Not only will this give you exclusive lifetime access to watch all the lessons whenever is best for you, you will also get all the interviews as downloadable audio files so you can learn on the go, full transcripts so you can read and analyze the great advice and tips, and exclusive bonuses not available to anyone else. Click the link below to get your All Access Pass now.